to turn to the book of Isaiah, chapter 42. Book of Isaiah, chapter 42, and we'd like to read the first four verses. Isaiah 42, verses 1 through 4. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. That is, he's not coming for himself. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. He shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He shall not fail, nor be discouraged, till he hath said judgment in the earth, and the isle shall wait for his law. By way of background to Isaiah and to the book of Isaiah, Isaiah's life, of course, life and ministry were in the midst of a divided kingdom. We know that the kingdom of Israel was made up of 12 tribes, and those 12 tribes were united from the time of Saul to the time of Solomon. Solomon was the last king of a united Israel. Upon the death of Solomon, it was assumed, of course, that his son Rehoboam would succeed him to the throne. Therefore, a coronation was planned. But the coronation was interrupted by the arrival of Jeroboam, who had organized 10 of the 12 tribes, basically for the purpose of collective bargaining. He wanted Rehoboam to promise that he would reduce the taxes, which became extremely high during Solomon's reign. And Rehoboam was given 3 days to consider the request of Jeroboam and the 10 tribes. And during that 3 days, we see that Rehoboam sought his father's counselors, but he rejected their advice. And he promised that he would not lower taxes, but that he would raise taxes even higher. Jeroboam and the 10 tribes withdrew from the coronation services, and the 10 tribes proceeded to elect Jeroboam as their king, establishing an independent kingdom. Rehoboam's first thought, of course, was to stop the succession by going to war against the 10 tribes, but the Lord forbade him, and Israel became divided. Northern kingdom, known throughout the Old Testament as Israel, had Samaria as its capital, and the southern kingdom, known as Judah, 2 tribes, had Jerusalem for their capital. As you read throughout the book of Kings, you see that the northern kingdom of Israel that started there with Jeroboam was consistently ruled by wicked kings, one wicked king after another. We see the Judah, on the other hand, had some good kings. They had some wicked kings, and then they would have a couple of godly kings and then another ungodly king. But I said all of that because Isaiah was a prophet in Judah, that is, the southern kingdom. And we read in Isaiah 1 and verse 1 that his ministry extended across the reign of four kings. He mentions four kings by name. They're in Isaiah 1 and verse 1. His most influential ministry, however, was while Hezekiah was king. It was while Hezekiah was king that the nation experienced probably its greatest spiritual revival, certainly its greatest since David anyway. We also see there in Isaiah 1 and verse 1 that we don't know a whole lot about Isaiah as far as the man. We do know some things. We see there in verse 1 of chapter 1 that he was the son of Amoz. Amoz, of course, was the brother to King Amaziah. Now, that would make Isaiah the cousin of Amaziah's son. Amaziah's son, of course, was Uzziah, one of the kings. And I believe this explains why Isaiah, who ministered during four kings, why Isaiah enjoyed a free pass into the royal courts to speak, because he was related. He was related to King Uzziah. We also learn from the book of Isaiah that Isaiah was a married man. We see that in chapter 7 or chapter 8 and verse 3, he referred to his wife as the prophetess. And as you read Isaiah, you see they had two sons. There in chapter 7 and verse 3, the one son was Shear-Jashub, which means a remnant shall return, which speaks of really the people that Isaiah ministered to. And the other son is mentioned there in chapter 8 and verse 3. Now the book of Isaiah, just like the Bible consists of 66 books. Isaiah consists of 66 chapters, 39 books in the Old Testament, and remainder of 27 in the New. And we see in Isaiah the first 39 chapters basically is what Isaiah lived, what Isaiah experienced. And in those first 39 chapters, Isaiah condemns sin over and over again, condemns the sin of the nation. And then in the remainder of the chapters, beginning with chapter 40, so our text falls in this section, 40 through 66, Isaiah writes to encourage and to comfort those who would be returning from Babylonian captivity. He'd been prophesying that they would go into Babylonian captivity. And then he spends the second half of the book trying to encourage those that would eventually return from Babylonian captivity. So what we read for our text is part of that encouragement, part of that comfort. Now the book of Isaiah is the second most quoted of all Old Testament books in the New Testament, followed, of course, only by the Psalms. Now, what we just read here in Isaiah 42 is quoted in Matthew chapter 12, verses 18 through verse 21. No Old Testament book speaks of Christ more than the book of Isaiah. Isaiah everywhere speaks of Jesus Christ, and our attention is constantly directed toward Jesus Christ. We want to speak tonight on the subject of the tenderness and compassion of Christ. We want to notice three things from what we just read in these verses. First of all, there's an admonition. Secondly, there's a promise, and then or a picture. And then thirdly, there is a promise. But first of all, notice the admonition there in verse 1. He says, "Behold my servant." Behold my servant. This is God referring to Jesus Christ. He referred to Christ as his servant in Isaiah 52 and verse 13. And he did again in Isaiah 53 and verse 11. But all attention here is directed toward the servant of God, Jesus Christ. Behold my servant. Now, some people will argue whether or not that is a command or an invitation. And I believe it's both. It is a command, we are to behold Jesus Christ. It is also an invitation to behold Jesus Christ. Being a command and an invitation, that means it is an obligation, but it is also a privilege. Behold my servant. And I believe that is where all our comfort is found. By beholding Jesus Christ. When you and I can learn this lesson, behold my servant. When in every circumstance that comes our way, we can learn to behold Jesus Christ, we'll be much better off. When we can learn to fix our eyes upon God's servant, God's perfect servant, Jesus Christ, that's where we find comfort. That's where we find peace. But that word behold means to ponder. It means to observe. It means to meditate upon. It means to give serious thought and serious consideration. And in this case, to the person of Jesus Christ. But notice what we are called upon to behold. He says, behold my servant. That speaks of the incarnation of Jesus Christ. That speaks of the humility of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ became a servant. Though he was God, he became a servant. He took upon him the form of a servant, and he came into the world as God's servant. And God says, I want you to behold him. I want you to ponder him. I want you to observe him. I want you to carefully consider him. I want you to meditate upon him, Jesus Christ. And again, we need to always do that. In beholding Jesus Christ, we see one who voluntarily subjected himself to the will and law of God as our representative. As such, he was sustained by God. Notice there in verse 1, he says, whom I uphold. Jesus Christ, though he was God, became flesh. And every step of his earthly ministry, he could not fall. He could not fail. Because every step of the way, God the Father upheld him. You go to the Garden of Temptation. You go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And you go to the cross. And everywhere you go, you see God upholding his servant, Jesus Christ. He does so for you and I. He also was a servant chosen by God. Mine elect. Mine elect. He was upheld and strengthened by God. He is God's chosen servant. But notice also, he is well pleasing to God, in whom my soul delighteth. God takes great delight in the person of Jesus Christ. Twice he said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. He said that at the baptism of Christ. He said it again on the Mount of Transfiguration. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. Here in Isaiah 42, he says, this is the one in whom my soul delighteth. And the only way that God can delight in sinful man is as he delights in them in Jesus Christ. The only way we can be accepted by God is in Jesus Christ. So he's well pleased with his Son. We also see that Jesus Christ was qualified for the work that he was sent to do. He says, I have put my spirit upon him. And as a man, Jesus Christ was filled with the Spirit above measure and without measure. And he was fully qualified to do the work he came to do. And he was fully successful in doing that work. He shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. Matthew quotes it by saying, in him the Gentiles shall trust. In other words, they would be saved. He came to save, and people would be saved. And the Lord invites us to behold my servant. How do we behold Jesus Christ? Can only do that by faith. And by faith we are to behold Jesus Christ. We're also to do that with a heart of admiration. As we behold Jesus Christ, as we read the Scriptures, I believe we can hear God saying, behold my servant. Behold my servant. Behold the one in whom I am well pleased. And again, once we learn to do that, everything gets better. We see things completely different when we see Christ. We ought to behold him with a thankful and grateful memory of who he is. And it ought to give us great comfort. It ought to give us great hope. It ought to give us great joy and strength. And nothing ought to motivate us more than beholding Jesus Christ. So these verses are written for comfort. And he begins by saying, behold my servant. And if you want comfort tonight, if you want peace, if you want assurance, that's where you begin. Behold my servant. But then, in verse 3, he draws us a picture. And it's really a picture of God's people, and strictly in the context, it's a picture of those who would return from Babylon. But he writes about two different plants in verse 3. He mentions a reed and a flax. And they are both pictures of God's people. The reed, of course, was very, very common in the Middle East. There were several varieties that grew there. The one most often referred to in the Word of God grew to a height of about 12 feet. When they were freshly cut, they were very flexible, very strong. And when God's people are what they ought to be, that's what they are. Flexible and strong. When they are dried, they become very stiff and strong. Again, that's what God's people are to be. The emphasis here is upon strength. But these reeds were used to make a variety of things. They were very useful. Very useful plant. It was used as a measuring device. They were told to take a reed and to measure. So it was used for a measuring device. It was used for a walking stick. Had to be strong. A measuring device, a walking stick, musical instruments were made from the reed. Writing instruments were made from the reed. Baskets were made from the reed. Vessels, spears were even made from the reed because of their jagged edges. A very, very useful plant. Not only that, shoes were made out of the reed. Bedding was made out of the reed. Sails for boats. Ropes were made from the reed. Paper was made from the reed. And sometimes they would just crush the reed for its fragrance. But as you look at everything about the reed, it was very useful. It had a variety of uses. Notice in Matthew chapter 27, keep a mark there in Isaiah, but in Matthew 27, we see that a reed was mockingly given to Jesus Christ as a symbol of royalty. In Matthew 27 and verse 29, when they had planted a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head and a reed in his right hand. A reed in his right hand. But I want you to notice that same reed, that very same reed, was taken from him and he was beaten with it. Notice verse 30. And they spit upon him and took the reed, the one they had placed in his hand, and smote him on the head. And then notice verse 48 of Matthew 27. And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. That is, they put that sponge upon that reed, that stick, and they lifted up the sponge with that vinegar to Christ. Again, from all of this, we see that the reed was very beneficial. Had a variety of uses. And may I say, when God's people are what they ought to be, and when God's people are where they ought to be, and are functioning as they should, they're very useful to God. So we have the reed. We also read of the flax. Now, flax was a very delicate plant, and it was gathered and dried and turned into thread. And from that, they would make linen cloths. We see that the priest's garments from the book of Exodus chapter 9 was made out of linen. And again, this linen was made from the flax. The ancient Canaanites grew this flax. In fact, we read in Joshua chapter 2 and verse 6 that Rahab had it upon the roof of her house, because that's where the spies hid, in the reeds on her house. In other words, they were there drying. So flax also were plants that were very useful for a variety of things. They were gathered, soaked in water to separate the fibers, and then placed upon the roofs, as in the example of Rahab, for the sun to dry them. And then the fibers were eventually, of course, spun into thread in linen cloth. But also we see that those threads were used for wicks in oil lamps. And that's what Isaiah 42 and verse 3 refers to. And a piece of thread would be placed in the oil, and the thread, of course, would be thoroughly soaked in the oil and then would be lit and would serve as a wick. It would give light within a house. So flax also is a picture of the people of God when they are functioning as they should. But let's be honest. As people of God, we do not always function as we should. We are not always where we ought to be, and we are not always useful to God. And that's what he makes reference to here in verse 3. He not only draws us a picture by using these two plants, the reed and the flax, But we see also there's a problem here in verse 3. Because the reed is bruised and the flax is quenched. It is smoking. This speaks of a problem. The bruised reed, to be bruised means to be broken. To be broken. To be crushed. And it's a picture of weakness. A bruised reed is a picture of weakness. Once the reed was bruised, it could not be used for any of the purposes that we've already mentioned. In other words, it's lost its effectiveness. We all get there at one time or another. Where because of our own doing, we lose our effectiveness spiritually. And we put ourselves in a place where God doesn't use us. A bruised reed. A bruised reed cannot even be crushed for its fragrance. It can't be used. It's lost its strength. And how often do God's people lose their strength? It's lost its stability. And how often God's people lose their stability? It's lost its soundness. It's become unreliable. How often? If we are not careful, we will become unreliable and even unusable to the Lord. So the problem here is a bruised reed. And then he mentions the smoking flax. Or in this case, the smoking wick. In other words, the fire has gone out. It's become dim, dull, or faint. The wick has dried out. There is no oil. There is no flame. Or the flame is almost extinguished. And how often that two pictures, God's people, who once shone brightly, but now just smoke. Hardly any light at all, just smoke. A lot of God's people are in that condition today. They do a lot of talking, but let's face it, just smoke. That's all it is. And they know what words to say. They've been around church people long enough. They've been around church long enough to know the language. But it's just smoke. There's no light. They've lost their light. A smoking flax is basically unusable. It's lost its purpose. Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 21 that we are to make sure that we are vessels unto honor, sanctified, that is set apart and fit for the master's use. But a bruised reed and a smoking flax is like a vessel that is no longer fit for the master's use. So both of these things, a bruised reed and a smoking flax, are pictures of a child of God who is no longer where they should be with the Lord. They once were, but they're no longer where they should be with the Lord. It is a picture of the wayward child of God. At one time, they were very usable to the Lord. But they've lost their strength. They've lost their stability. They've lost their soundness. They've lost their light. And they're just smoke. Very little use. They have ceased to function. A bruised reed no longer can function. A smoking flax no longer functions as it was intended to function. And how many times God's people cease to function as the Lord intended us to function? And again, this is because of our own doing. There are times, again, when we all become bruised reeds. There are times when we all become a smoking flax. But I want you to notice the patience of the Lord. To me, God's grace is an amazing thing, and part of God's grace, of course, is His long-suffering. And I think often upon the patience of the Lord. It is true that God is a God of anger. It is true that God possesses wrath. But God is a God of patience. God is a God of great long suffering, especially with the bruised reed and the smoking flax. And that's the lesson that is taught here in verse 3. It says there in verse 3, a bruised reed shall he not break. A bruised reed, again, has lost its usefulness. So here's a child of God. By their own doing, they have lost their usefulness to the Lord. But God says, I won't destroy it. And that's what the word break here means. He says, I'm not going to break it into pieces. I'm not going to tear it into pieces. That's what you and I might do. But God says, a bruised reed shall he not break. Now the Lord sees the weakness. The Lord sees the weakness of that bruised reed. The Lord sees how useless that bruised reed has become. What does he do? Does he just reach out in his anger and finish it off? If that was the case, none of us would be here tonight. But God's been patient. God's been long-suffering with the bruised reed. God sees that bruised reed. He sees how weak it's become. He sees how useless it has become. Does he destroy it? He says, no, I won't break it. In other words, I will not destroy it. But what does God do? He said, well, there have been times when I've been that bruised reed and God has made me miserable and God has chastened me, but he didn't destroy you. And everything that he did was to mend you. You see, that's what God does with the bruised reed. He doesn't come to destroy it, he comes to mend it. He comes to repair it, to reinforce it, and to restore it. And that takes great patience. That takes tremendous long-suffering for God to mend the bruised reed. Because many times God mends that bruised reed, and then we do the same thing over again, and again we become bruised. And many live their lives that way. God is patient. God is long-suffering. He also says that he will not quench. The smoking flax shall he not quench or put out or extinguish. He doesn't just snuff out the smoldering wick, though it's become useless. Just sending off smoke. no light. Instead, he comes to rekindle it. Now, he may put you through much, but it's not to destroy you. It's not to hurt you. It's to rekindle. It's to rekindle the flame. To make you useful. Again, only God can take a bruised reed and a smoking flax and make it useful again. Only God can take a child of God who has ruined their lives and put it back together again. Only God can do that. And He does. And He does over and over and over again. Now, if you look in any church building, this one's no exception, it's true that God has had compassion on many bruised reeds in this building tonight. How much compassion and how much long-suffering God has had upon the bruised reeds. Throughout the history of Home Baptist Church, how many times God has had compassion on the bruised reeds. Had He reached out in anger and destroyed them, we wouldn't be here. Home Baptist Church wouldn't be here. The very fact that we're here is testimony that He has mended bruised reeds. So never give up. When a child of God becomes a bruised reed, don't ever give up. Because God can mend that bruised reed. And I believe with all of my heart that if they're truly saved, God is in the process of mending them, whether they know it or not. Have there not been times when it would have been very easy for God to simply break you in two? It's true of all of us. Wouldn't that have been what we deserve?